The Political Pulse, 2 weeks till Election Day. This is not your usual off-year election season. Across the nation, pandemic restrictions have fired up first-time candidates aligned with President Trump who are running for local offices. Here in Maine, a referendum question about the CMP corridor has garnered more than $60 million in campaign spending. Voters will also decide a $100 million bond question and constitutional amendment on the right to food. All of this against the backdrop of redistricting, which will influence next year's legislative and congressional elections. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we kick off a week-long focus on politics and elections. Later this week, we will discuss questions 1 and 3 on the Maine ballot in depth. On this show, we look at the big picture with Maine Public's Steve Missler and USM political scientist Ron Schmidt. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. In 2 weeks, Maine voters head to the polls. It is an off-year election, but doesn't really feel like it. Joining me for this hour to talk about the election here in Maine and what's going on in politics here and nationwide, Steve Missler, who's Maine Public's chief politics and government correspondent, and Ron Schmidt, professor of political science at the University of Southern Maine. He is the author of Reading Politics with Machiavelli. We invite your comments and questions. Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page or to Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. And I want to mention that all this week we will be focusing on the election and politics on Maine Calling. Tomorrow the program will focus on question 1 and Wednesday on question 3. Today we are taking a broad look at what this election means and what's going on in politics in Maine and around the country. Well, thank you, Steve, and thank you, Ron, for joining us. Steve, all voters in Maine are going to face 3 ballot questions. Question 1, that citizen initiative. We keep seeing the ads about the citizen initiative aiming to halt the CMP corridor. Question 2, an infrastructure bond question. And question 3, a constitutional amendment regarding the right to grow one's food. As I mentioned, we will be focusing on those questions later in the week. But I want to ask you, what are people going to see on local ballots across the state in this odd year election?
Well, Jen, there are a lot of local races for seats like the school board, city council, select boards all over the state. Now, these races don't get a lot of attention, but they're really important, and they're becoming increasingly partisan in some parts of the state as national politics trickles down. Some of this is part of a national playbook, but you know, you can see this in races for the city council in Portland, where voters can witness firsthand this tension between traditional Democrats, if you will, and ascendant progressive movement that's been in the news quite a bit over the past few years and a lot over the last week or so. There's also a city referendum that's kind of a multiple choice question to determine how or if the city proceeds in building a new shelter for the unhoused. Legislative races are not until next year, but we do have one special election in the city of Augusta to replace a Republican legislator who recently resigned. I'm sure that contest between Democratic candidate Reagan LaRochelle, and I hope I pronounced that correctly, and Republican James Orr, it will be analyzed and dissected to see if it has any sort of, you know, predictive powers for next year's legislative elections.
Ron, what are we seeing around the country? Any races of note? Again, it's 2021, an odd year, but there are some races that are pretty important going to take place two Tuesdays from tomorrow.
Thank you for having me on, Jennifer. Yeah, there are some races that are getting a lot of attention, justifiably. Some of that is because people are trying to prognosticate what to expect about next year. We heard a lot of that conversation around the recall election in California last month about what that might have to tell us about national Republican or Democratic candidates. And we're hearing some of that talk also this year with the Virginia race. But of course, Virginia politics in and of itself is significant. And that race is close. Terry McAuliffe has been a governor in Virginia before. They have a kind of term limits where a governor can run again, but not immediately after their term. So he's coming back for another try. And is being challenged by a man named Youngkin, who's been endorsed by former President Donald Trump, but who's doing a lot of work trying to reassure Republicans that he stands with Trump and trying to reassure independents that he doesn't stand too close.
Mm. You mentioned the California recall, the Gavin Newsom recall election, which, of course, failed. And I'm wondering, Ron, do you think that really does have national implications? I always think of California as a world unto itself, but maybe my read is false.
My gut is that it's too far out to look for to try to read the tea leaves, and that California is a peculiar situation in and of itself. But I learned, you know, over 4 years ago to not be too quick to dismiss the shifting ground under our feet. I think that we're probably looking there at a special case.
Okay. I want to shift to looking at how the pandemic has influenced the political scene. And Ron, I'm going to turn back to you. How has the pandemic influenced local races across the country? I'm reading about the pandemic having an effect on school board races.
Yes. In a way that's sort of bizarre, but in another way that fits in with our particular moment, precautions against a global pandemic have become politically controversial. And that controversy is really reaching kind of a fever point at local school board elections. There's been a lot of pushback in some school districts against regulations concerning mask usage, against limitations on how closely students can be next to each other in rooms, as well as some implications about the power of parents to second guess teachers or administrators. It looks, from what I've been seeing, like a certain amount of this is sort of astroturf. There seems to be some scripts in place that parents can use if they're upset about precautions against the coronavirus. And so we're hearing a lot of the same sort of rhetoric from angry parents around the country. It's an odd situation. I mean, on the one hand, we're seeing very, very local races becoming nationalized. We're hearing the kind of rhetoric that we hear in national elections being used on town council and school board elections, which is weird. On the other hand, these national races could not be more intimate or related to our daily lives in our local communities. And we're talking here about the basic health and safety of our children. So.
And Steve, are we seeing this here in Maine? Most of the articles I've read about are about places like Ohio. Are we seeing local school board races affected by the pandemic and affected by remote learning and mask mandates here in Maine?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't done a thorough analysis of the local races and the candidates and what they're talking about, but there certainly has been exactly what Ron has just mentioned here in Maine. Remember, just this year, there was a failed attempt to recall four members of the school board in SAD 51, which covers Cumberland and North Yarmouth. And that turned out to be part of this national playbook that I referenced earlier by conservatives and aligned advocacy groups to try and spark, you know, this grassroots uprising against the teaching of critical race theory or mask mandates, what have you. These kind of, you know, recall efforts are taking place all over the country, and school boards have become targets for the conservative movement in general as it tries to bring back the energy from the Tea Party movement, you know, that was in the, you know, 2009, 2010. School board meetings have become quite contentious. There have been resignations. Some administrators have been removed or decided to quit. This is nationally. And some examples in Maine include this dust up in Cumberland that I mentioned. There was also a recent dispute in Skowhegan when parents objected to that district's mask mandate for the early part of the school year. Recently in the Rockland area district, the school board had to move its recent meeting to a remote setting after a statewide anti-mask and anti-vaccination group said it would appear there to protest the board's consideration of a mask mandate. And even, you know, in August, there were parents in Hamden who spoke out quite vehemently against a mask mandate in that school district. So, you know, the extent to which these issues are coloring local races for those seats isn't totally clear, but I would not be surprised if it's not happening.
And Ron,
if it is happening, excuse me, sorry.
Yeah. And Ron, let me ask you this. When we see these candidates running for things like local school board, do they run on an overt platform of overturning the status quo, or do they kind of run quietly and wait until they are in place? Do they run maybe for an open seat and they're the only candidate and then wait until they're in place to really start to make changes or try to make changes? Is there a trend?
I haven't done enough of a comparative analysis to give you a definitive answer on that. But I can tell you that I think, at least in terms of the races nationally that I've seen, they really hit the ground running in trying to drum up a lot of grassroots support behind first their candidacy and then secondly behind the particular issues or causes that they attach themselves to.
Let's turn, Steve, to the bond question on the ballot. We're as voters in Maine used to facing several bond questions. I think it's unusual, and tell me if I'm wrong, to face only one. Why are we only facing one bond issue, especially when there are low interest rates? And then tell us about this bond issue, what it would do.
Sure. No, you're absolutely right, especially in recent years, last 10 or so, that we're accustomed to seeing multiple bond questions on the ballot. The reason you're not seeing them this year, Jen, I think, is that we've had this massive infusion of federal money to help pay for things that the state might otherwise borrow for. And those infusions were designed to stabilize the economy and spur growth as we try to dig out of the pandemic. So with all that money coming in, there was this real, you know, reluctance by some state lawmakers, Republicans in particular, to ask voters to borrow more. And, you know, the only way we get bond initiatives on the ballot in the first place is via a two-thirds vote by the legislature. So Democrats, while they may have been supportive of additional bond measures, they don't have a supermajority or a two-thirds margin in order to pass these things on their own. So there just wasn't enough to send these other borrowing initiatives to voters. So we ended up with just one, question two, which basically asks voters to borrow $100 million for transportation upgrades to things like roads and bridges, as well as some upgrades to ports, marine facilities, passenger rail, airports, what have you. You know, proponents argue that this funding is needed to help the state dig out of this pretty big backlog of transportation projects and capital investment and to fix its aging infrastructure. So that's why it's there. And that's why I got the two-thirds vote in the legislature to even get it on the ballot.
And wasn't there some talk earlier in the legislative session of having some sort of omnibus bond measure that was going to have things like broadband in it and conservation land and more than just transportation? I was actually kind of surprised when I was reading this bond measure that it was primarily transportation infrastructure. I thought it included much more.
No, it really is just transportation focused. There was some discussion about that, having this omnibus bond proposal that you mentioned. Short-lived though, honestly, because you know, it was pretty clear early on that there wasn't going to be enough votes to clear such a initiative. And you know, you mentioned broadband. You know, we've got a lot of money coming in to fix broadband in this state, or to upgrade it in a lot of cases, or to even make it present in some rural areas. And a lot of that money, you know, where it just is waiting to be spent. And, you know, to the extent that, you know, Governor Mills had to create basically a new agency to distribute broadband money. So there's a lot of money sitting there for these specific purposes that would otherwise have been bonded. But we just happen to have a lot of federal cash in the bank that will go to those initiatives further down the road.
All right. So, Ron, here in Maine, we're going to be voting yet again on a transportation infrastructure bond measure at the same time that the big discussion, of course, in Washington is about President Biden's plan that the Democrats call the Build Back Better plan. So, you know, it's really all about infrastructure right now. In Maine, these bond measures almost always pass, and they pass fairly easily. But it's pretty difficult on the federal level to get Congress excited about infrastructure. Why is that? Is that the case? If we went state by state, is it easier to pass infrastructure on the local level than, or in the state level than federal level?
Well, to take your last question first, I've lived a few places in the United States, and I've been impressed with just how seriously New Englanders take basic infrastructure as something that they have to deal with. I think that there's something about coming out of the thaw every single year that sort of forcibly reminds us of the need to make sure that we can drive down the street without losing a tire. In regards to the larger problems, there's just a lot of things happening all at once. One thing, of course, is that the Biden administration does not have any leeway at all in Congress in trying to pass its priorities into legislation. And they don't have the luxury of a lot of time with the next set of elections coming up next year. All other things being equal, usually a sitting president's party takes a hit during those first midterms. And so there's a lot of pressure on them to do whatever big stuff they want to get done, done. They're not getting any voting support from the GOP, except in regard to the earlier passed, fairly narrowly defined infrastructure bill. The Biden administration has in mind a much broader idea of the meaning of infrastructure, their Build Back Better plan. And those two legislative packages came together really as sort of a combination package for the Democrats to try to get their priorities passed. That is leading to opposition from the GOP, but also to these issues within the Democratic Party itself. This kind of big legislation is hard to manage under the best of circumstances. And from the perspective of President Biden, these are not the best of circumstances. The Democrats are a big and fairly diverse party. They don't have the kind of centralization around one figure like the GOP has post 2016. And all things considered, I think they're holding together fairly well. But all of this could still come apart before it's over.
Mm. Steve, before we need to go to break, I want to ask you about our delegation in Biden's infrastructure plan. Where do they stand?
Well, they all support it, Jen, and some of them more enthusiastically than others. And I think one of the reasons why is that a couple of them are sort of hung up in this this fight that Ron just alluded to, which is that you have Biden's Build Back Better initiative, which was originally pegged at 10 trillion. They've got it down to 3.5 trillion, and then it's might be between 1.5 and 2.2, depending on what day it is, trillion dollars. And what, you know, progressives really want that proposal. So does the Biden administration. And the initial plan was to run that proposal alongside the infrastructure bill, which already cleared the Senate. So, but there's some disputes over whether they should do that. In fact, Second District Congressman Jared Golden has basically said that he wants to vote on infrastructure right now. He does not want to vote on these bills in tandem because I don't think he's necessarily supportive of Build Back Better. That's at least the signals that he's sending. And, you know, and I think Senator Susan Collins is of similar mind on this. She would definitely vote for not Build Back Better. I don't think she's ever going to vote for that, but she definitely is. She's already voted for the infrastructure package. And so I think, you know, you have moderate Democrats or a couple of them anyway, that want these bills separated, but that's not going to happen. And so it's created a lot of really tough negotiations within the Democratic Party. With both sides sort of, you know, standing off and with time running out, quite frankly, because they have to, resolve all this if they want to pass either or both before the end of the year.
All right. Well, we still have not talked about what is going on right now might mean for next year. What's going on with the governor's race, with congressional races? And we will talk about all of that after the break. This is Maine Calling. We're talking about elections and politics in Maine. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, or send an email, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the Lunder Foundation in support of the Colby College Museum of Art, or bringing the museum to you online at colby.edu/museum. And by A Family for Me, a Spurwing program committed to raising awareness of the need for foster and adoptive parents. Learn more at afamilyformemaine.org.
Wind turbines can be 650 feet tall. It takes time and energy to make sure they run right, you know.
It's nice to know that your time and your energy is contributing to this world that runs on green energy, and it's something what's going to be a better future for everybody.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We go offshore wind farming next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace today at 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public is pleased to be a media sponsor of the Phantom of the Opera, presented by Friends of the Kochmar Organ in Portland's Merrill Auditorium. Join organist James Kennerly as he brings life, intrigue, and musical accompaniment to the 1925 silent horror film. A live performance is happening on Saturday evening, October 30th, and a pre-recorded on-demand version will be available through November 1st. Maine Public members are eligible for 15% off tickets for the live event. For complete details, please visit mainpublic.org and click on events.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You are listening to Maine Calling. Our topic today is the Maine political scene, especially with the election coming up in 2 weeks. Joining me, Ron Schmidt, professor of political science at the University of Southern Maine and author of Reading Politics with Machiavelli, and Steve Missler is Maine Public's chief politics and government correspondent. You can join our conversation, and please do, at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. Tell us if something is going on in your town, in your community. What's on the ballot that you care about? And what do you think its implications are, not only in your community, but for the state and for the nation? Okay, let's talk about the 2022 election, because it is already underway, isn't it, Steve? What about the governor's race? What do we know?
Well, right now, Jen, it's this matchup that many have anticipated since, you know, Governor Janet Mills won her first term in 2018. Former Governor Paula Page is making a bid for a third term, unprecedented, after a brief hiatus in Florida. He's been talking about this since before he even left office. I'll never forget the interview you did with him during his final days in office, when he pretty much telegraphed that he was coming back. And he has, he held a kickoff event at the Augusta Civic Center last month. He's got the entire Maine GOP behind him, and, you know, including, I might add, Senator Susan Collins, who has endorsed his reelection bid. Not a total surprise, given that she's backed him twice before, but certainly noteworthy given the frosty relationship the two of them had in the early part of the Trump presidency. You know, that relationship began to thaw when LePage endorsed Collins in her reelection bid last year. Now she's returning the favor. Mills, meanwhile, has not officially announced her reelection bid, but she's fundraising like crazy and increased her public appearances, including one today in the crucial electoral battleground of Lewiston. We don't have a third party challenger yet, but that's always a possibility in Maine. And that obviously makes Democrats nervous, because they're always concerned that splitting the electorate between independents and Democrats would give LePage a path. And remember, there's no ranked choice voting in the governor's race. I feel like I have to say that all the time, because we have it in congressional races, people assume that it's in the governor's race, but it's only, we only have it in primaries, gubernatorial primaries, not the general election. Just add one more thing here, which is that Mills has had some issues on her left flank, you know, mainly some disenchantment among progressives that have led some to call for her, for a primary against her. That has not materialized, despite some efforts by a group of Portland activists who tried to get Senate President Troy Jackson to run, but he's not doing that. But even if there's no primary, you know, Mills may need to energize that left flank, because if history tells us anything, it's that the party out of power in the White House often has an enthusiasm advantage versus the power, versus the party that is in power, that usually has a disadvantage. And so, you know, Republicans have the, you know, wins at their back, it would appear that way anyway. And so Mills might have to make some overtures to that left flank to make sure those folks turn out for her next year.
And Steve, what's the timing if there is going to be a primary challenger, or if there are going to be primary challengers to Janet Mills, or if there are going to be other Republicans? What is the timing? When do they have to have their name in, and when do they sort of practically need to have their name in by?
Yeah, I forget the exact date, Jen, but it's close to March, I believe, is when you'd have to gather your signatures in order to get on the ballot for a primary. That's usually the deadline. I'm not sure if that's the case next year, but usually March. But honestly, if you're going to, you know, initiate a primary, like, now's the time, especially if you're somebody who isn't very well known. And so you would need to get you need to be out there and get in front of people to build up, A, to even qualify for the ballot, and also just to get voters to know who you are. So that would be, that's those are the hurdles that one would have to leap in order to qualify. So
Ron, what is your, I want to hear your perspective on Governor LePage. I was going to ask you, what is the political calculation he's making by making his announcement now? But we really do know that he's never made a secret of saying he's kind of announced over and over and over again that he's going to run again. So it doesn't seem like timing has really been the thing. What do you think in terms of is Governor LePage reading the tea leaves, reading the polls, or does he just believe that the power of his personality and charisma is going to win the day?
Governor LePage said famously a few years back that he was Donald Trump before Donald Trump. And yet he, in some ways, is walking that same careful line that Youngkin is down in Virginia. Back when he was a governor, for example, he wasn't always a real team player with the Maine GOP. And this time around, he's very much trying to be supportive of other Republican candidates down the polls. So he's trying to send a message that he's different in that way. The word that went out, at least before he announced, was that he's mellowed and that we should expect a mellower race this time. So the Maine GOP is to some degree trying to eat their cake and have it, so sort of tell us that he's Trumpy enough for Maine Republicans, but not so Trumpy that he'll drive away independents or suburban Republicans. And of course, the electoral ground has shifted a little bit in Maine. The Democratic numbers are higher than they were when he went to victory the first time. I think they outnumber even independents in Maine now. And so that necessitates, to some degree, somewhat of a different strategy. But I mean, we remember Paula Page. She had a very, very well-defined political identity. So I'm not sure to what degree that's gonna work. And my guess is at the end of the day, the former governor figures that particular type of politicking is gonna energize his base enough to give him another shot at winning, even if it turns off some independents.
Steve, are there any early poll numbers?
Yeah, there was a recent one that was commissioned by Spectrum News that, you know, indicated that Governor Mills had a little bit of her approval rating had sunk a little bit to a point where, you know, things look conceivable for LePage to defeat her. I mean, history is not on his side. We haven't had an incumbent governor lose, I think, since it was like 1969 or something therein. That's not favoring him. But Ron indicated something that I think is important, which is that there is national tailwinds for LePage in a lot of ways, just because of the midterms and the Republicans being out of power. The balancing act that Ron also referred to is also going to be interesting to watch. He during his rally or his kickoff rally in September, it was really kind of an interesting event in the sense that we didn't see a lot of the broadsides and sort of stream of consciousness riffing that we saw from LePage when he held this all these town hall meetings around the state. He really stuck to the script. And I remember when I was looking at the tape from that, because I was writing a story about it and looking at the waveform, and there were very few applause lines. There wasn't a lot of raucous reaction to what he had to say. And I think that speaks to something that Ron mentioned, which is that, you know, one of the reasons I think LePage has had such rock hard support from the GOP is that he's energized them with his conduct in some ways, or the way he talks about Democrats or things that he doesn't like. And I think a lot of voters like that, just as they did with Trump. They don't always want to admit it sometimes, but I think that's true. And so he runs this risk if he's trying to, you know, moderate himself, of maybe not energizing those people as much as he otherwise would. So it'll be interesting to see how they play that. Maybe he just has a different message for a broader audience, such as the press and myself. And then when he talks to these other groups that he's going to need to turn out for him, maybe he is more of that fire and brimstone guy that we're all accustomed to. Who knows? We'll have to wait and see how it turns out. But it is clear that they are trying to strike or trying to walk this fine line between being the LePage of old and quote unquote LePage 2.0.
Ron?
To the degree to which, too, that he was Trump before Trump, he's got to be conscious of this problem Trump had, which is that as much as he energized his base, he also energized the Democratic opposition. And things will be much better for LePage if Mills' support remains somewhat divided and more apathetic.
And I'm
the more excited they get.
It's really hard to read a race this far out, a year out. And I'm guessing, Ron, it's especially hard in the middle of a pandemic. There is no, there's nothing you can go back and study and say, well, I guess you could study 1918, but the last time there was a global pandemic and governors had to make really hard choices, how did that affect the outcome of elections, right?
Yeah, the return to normalcy was the winning battle cry in 1920. But now I think that the very definition of normalcy is so hotly debated that that wouldn't have the same kind of cachet.
Right. I'll just add to that. I'm kind of curious because it's clear that Governor LePage or former Governor LePage wants to run a little bit on Governor Mills's pandemic response. But I don't know. And I think we'll have to wait a year basically to find out how much of this stuff sticks with voters. You know, I mean, can you run a campaign against a sitting governor basically Monday morning quarterbacking decisions that that governor made during the course of a, you know, once in a lifetime pandemic? I don't know. Perhaps you can. And maybe LePage won't do that as much as some think he might. And so we'll have to see how that pans out. But it is something to watch for. And we're seeing it right now. I mean, the Republican Party and LePage, his campaign, are, you know, really going after Governor Mills on this vaccine mandate for healthcare workers. That's been in the news for more than a week. And, you know, because their Republicans are alleging that it's worsening a healthcare worker shortage in the state. And so, you know, and the governor is not backing down from this mandate. So it'll be really interesting to see if that's the kind of tack they take all the way through to next November.
Let's talk about congressional races. Steve, Bruce Poliquin challenging Jared Golden, right?
Yeah, what's old is new again. Poliquin is making a comeback. He held that seat for two terms before getting bounced by Golden in 2018. Remember, Golden eked out that win after the country's first ranked choice runoff decided a congressional contest. So Poliquin has had some difficulty acknowledging that defeat because of the ranked choice result, and he apparently still does. When he announced, he said over the summer that he beat Golden and he plans to do it again. I expect it'll be a really expensive race, just as it was in 2018 when it broke spending records for a congressional contest in Maine. Those records now look pretty quaint compared to the $200 million U.S. Senate race we had last year and the anticipated $70 million gubernatorial race we're expecting next year. So it's a swing seat. National Republicans have their eye on it because Golden is a Democrat in a very Trumpy district. That's why I think, you know, you've seen him take some votes that have really ticked off Democrats, but are probably pretty frustrating to Republicans because they can't, you know, really pigeonhole him as some sort of, you know, reckless liberal with a spending addiction.
And Poliquin's had to move, right?
That's right. I think last I heard he was going to rent an apartment in Bangor, but his full-time residence is, or the one that he owns anyway, is in Georgetown, which is securely in the first district.
Okay. And Ron, Steve was talking about money. I've read that next year is going to be a record year for spending. I'm wondering, and Steve mentioned some really big numbers. At what point does it even matter anymore? I mean, how many political ads can be bought? How many flyers can be mailed? Do these numbers even mean anything?
Next year is already becoming a record year in terms of fundraising, and I mean, you remember last year. I'm a political junkie, and there's a point at which I can't handle the level of advertising that we're inundated by, and there is always somewhat of a risk that their voters are going to be put off by that sort of thing. But I think everyone is afraid that last dollar they chose not to spend is going to feel decisive. And so we wind up in this kind of escalating buildup. At the end of the day, I don't know how effective spending is beyond a certain point, but it's sort of a cliche in political science that candidates tend to run scared, to always feel like defeat is just peeking around the corner. And so there's a lot of anxiety about not spending money when the money is still an option.
All right. Well, a few questions coming in. If you'd like to join those questions, we will be getting to some of them after the break. The phone number 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, if you're quick, talk@mainepublic.org. You can send a tweet at Maine Calling or find us on Facebook or Instagram. We're also going to talk about redistricting. Please stay with us.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Sherman's Maine Coast Bookshops, celebrating their 135th year with new locations now open in Rockland, Topsom, and Windham, shermans.com, and by the Fresh Eggs Daily Cookbook by Maine author Lisa Steele, helping to inspire Mainers to eat eggs daily, available for pre-order wherever books are sold.
I'm Scott Tong. Student athletes are back in college for the first time since the Supreme Court allowed them to monetize their name, image, and likeness. How's it going?
Student athletes are not getting the types of sponsorship deals they may have expected. Hundreds of thousands of dollars are generally not drifting down from heaven like manna on students.
That's the next time on Here and Now.
Stay with us here now, upcoming shortly at 12 noon today here on Maine Public Radio. Balanced, in-depth coverage of local, state, and national politics is at the heart of public broadcasting, and keeping the electorate informed about the issues is important to Maine and central to the mission of Maine Public. Maine Public's Political Pulse is a weekly discussion of the politics here at home with Chief Political Correspondent and State House Bureau Chief Steve Missler. The Pulse can be heard on Fridays during All Things Considered, and it's also available as a weekly podcast and a newsletter at mainepublic.org. You can have the Maine Public Political Pulse newsletter delivered straight to your inbox on Friday mornings by subscribing at mainepublic.org/pulse.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're talking about Maine politics and election issues. My guest, USM political science professor Ron Schmidt, and Maine Public chief politics and government correspondent Steve Missler. Share your comments or questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page or to Instagram, or give us a call 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to an email from Greg. He asks, could you ask your guests why it is relatively easy to modify Maine's constitution for some issues? Example question 3, which would add an amendment to the state constitution protecting the right to produce, harvest, and consume food. Yet it seems an impossibility to modify it to allow ranked choice voting for governor. What's the difference? And so I just want to take a moment to say that we will be focusing on question 3 on Wednesday and question 1 tomorrow. But the constitutional question, Steve, I think it's a good one. How come it seems easier for some things than for others?
Well, it all boils down, Jen, to the legislature. So in order to even get a constitutional amendment on the ballot, 2/3 of the legislature has to agree to send it there for voters to ratify. So on the question of the right to food, a constitutional amendment that you'll see as question 3, there was broad bipartisan support for that, a supermajority in the legislature, which is a rare thing in and of itself, to put that before voters, which is why you're seeing that you'll see that on November 2nd. As it relates to ranked choice voting, what happened with ranked choice voting is that issue became quickly very partisan and a lot of that was because of Bruce Poliquin's loss in 2018. If there was already sort of this erosion amongst the GOP or sort of skepticism about ranked choice voting because they saw it as an attack on Governor Paula Page or, hardline conservatives and as potentially blocking them from winning statewide elections. And so when Poliquin lost in the second congressional district, that really hardened their opposition to ranked choice voting. So you will not see Republicans voting for a ranked choice voting constitutional amendment. That's why it'll never get to voters unless there becomes a supermajority of Democrats in the legislature who want to send it there. And I'm not even sure that all Democrats like ranked choice voting as much as, say, independents do. And independents were really the group of individuals that were behind that measure when it was passed by voters in 2016, and that's why we have it now. So that is the long answer. I could probably have done it a lot more succinctly, but that's, at the end of the day, it's really up to the legislature to send constitutional amendments to voters.
Good answer. And, you know, while we're talking about ranked choice voting, let me ask you, Ron, whether you think that ranked choice voting is picking up any kind of steam nationwide. We know that it was in New York City's mayoral race recently. And what I seem to read about it is that maybe it's just that people in New York like to complain, but there sure was a lot of complaining about ranked choice voting in New York City's mayoral race. Do you feel as though it's going to stay an outlier, that this is going to be something that Maine and New York have and a few other cities? Or do you see, as a political scientist, ranked choice voting as an option that will indeed continue to pick up steam and may even be more commonplace in the near future?
I mean, ranked choice voting does have some positives for what are undeniably issues in our election system, right? It can deal with the issue of the sort of spoiler effect. It can also, and we've seen this now for a long time, because ranked choice voting existed a while back in certain towns and cities. It gives voters the sense that their votes are more rationally cast and that their concerns are being heard by local elected officials, which is a huge deal in a system where there's a concerted attempt by the former president and others to undermine people's faith in the legitimacy of the system. But Americans are pretty conservative when it comes to shifts and changes in their voting systems. I guess I would not bet a lot of money on it sort of sweeping the nation, even though I think there are reasons why it might.
We'll go to Tyler, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Tyler, go ahead.
Hi, my name's Tyler O'Neill. I'm just calling to say that I think it's really important for Democrats to organize early against LePage. And I also wanted to bring awareness to the fact that LePage is having a fundraiser on Wednesday in Kennebunkport, and we'll be having a protest there starting at 5:30 when everyone's getting there.
Okay, Tyler, thanks for calling. And Steve, we see the political organizing underway. You're nodding, grinning.
Yeah, no, it's funny because that the event that the caller just referenced is actually going to be attended by New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu, and he's going to be there to, you know, basically stump for LePage, which is interesting given that Sununu is a governor. He's more of the New England sort of archetype for governors, right, or for Republican governors or Republican politicians, which is moderate. I mean, if you actually were to compare Governor Sununu's pandemic response to Governor Mills, they're pretty similar. Same with Vermont, where Phil Scott is a Republican governor. Actually, Vermont had some of the more prohibitive restrictions in the country. But these three governors, Scott, Mills, and Sununu, often worked together, especially as it related to sort of trying to synchronize travel restrictions between the states. So it's interesting to see Sununu stumping for LePage, but Sununu also has his own potential electoral ambitions because there's a lot of chatter about him running for the U.S. Senate. So it's kind of it serves both candidates' purpose, which is helps LePage campaigning with Sununu, maybe helps that modifying effort that his campaign is trying to construct. And for Sununu, it's always good to stand next to a conservative firebrand if you don't have that kind of support amongst the Trump base, as some other people like LePage definitely do.
An email here from Scott, and he's talking about the state rep race in Augusta. He says, I don't think this race will be an accurate sign of things to come next year. I'm in this district, and it has leaned right for many years, despite my voting left each time. We have a few minutes left, and Ron, I want to talk about redistricting with both of you. How much, and we'll start with the national map, how much will, now that the census figures are out, and I know that a lot of states are in the thick of this, Maine is done with it, but a lot of states are not, how much is this going to affect the election next year, the congressional election, and in what way?
I mean, the census got off to a late start because of some issues with funding and support, and that could change the effect on the calendar for next year. But redistricting is a really important part of a Congress in which the majorities are so razor thin as they are at this point. We're seeing attempts by both parties, and this has been approved of by the Supreme Court, in building on partisan advantages and also building on the advantages of incumbency. So in a place like Texas, we're seeing the GOP trying to consolidate and grow their power. That's definitely going to have an effect in some states on rules about who can vote and new restrictions to the franchise. It's important under any circumstances, but when Congress is as close as it is right now, it's crucial.
And Ron, let me ask you about, again, about timing here. We're looking, you mentioned states like Texas, where whatever map is come up with, it will almost assuredly be challenged in the courts. Is there time to get this all mapped out and figured out and settled before the midterm election?
Possibly not. We may wind up with this sort of dragging on into mid-decade. I'm not sure yet, honestly.
Okay. And Steve, what we have heard and what guests have said on this program is that the redistricting in Maine is so fair and done by a bipartisan commission, and the map, at the way it's drawn, tries to guarantee as many incumbents stay in their seats as possible. Yet the reality is that more people have moved to southern Maine than northern Maine, and that the districts did have to be redrawn. Is it not the case that after next year's election, that the likelihood is that more races will be races in districts that are more heavily Democratic than Republican?
Not necessarily, but I'll start big picture, which is the congressional redistricting effort, which essentially, because of the census numbers and this population growth, very modest as it turns out, in southern Maine, almost exclusively required the commission that you also mentioned to move about 23,000 voters from the first congressional district into the second. Now, almost all of that movement occurred within Kennebec County, which was already divided between the first and the second district. So, you know, most of the towns that moved into the second district are pretty swingy with no real sort of partisan lean. I think we had an emailer reference Augusta. I mean, when I first started covering the State House, Augusta was considered a Democratic stronghold, but yet, you know, the race, the special election I referenced earlier in the program, is replacing a Republican who resigned. And we also have a Republican state senator who also happens to be in leadership in the state Senate. So the emailer was correct that this is, you know, it's more Republican here in Augusta than I think we're accustomed to in the past. And I think these other towns that I mentioned that are moved into the second district are also, again, very swingy. There's just not a partisan advantage that I can discern of, at least looking at election results. But it's true that perhaps the second district will get slightly bluer as a result of redistricting, but I don't think you're going to see that show up unless it's a super close race. Certainly the second congressional district race next year could be very close.
Sure. Maybe I wasn't clear enough. I'm thinking that there must be more legislative districts that more of Maine's legislative districts will be in southern Maine, and southern Maine does swing a little more blue than northern Maine and central Maine.
You're absolutely right. So if you actually were to look at the new redistricting map and you looked at this myriad of state Senate districts in the southern part of the state, you could take all of the ones that are in Cumberland County and maybe in a few in York County, and you could shove them all into one state Senate district in Aroostook County. So you're talking about massive rural districts in the northern and western part of the state. And then once you get down into Cumberland County, you're seeing a lot of smaller districts that have the same population requirement required for apportionment. So it's very true. I think what you'll see, though, is that a lot of the divisions within those southern districts are in suburban and bedroom communities to Portland. And those suburban districts are not necessarily, you know, super blue. They, in some cases, are very purple. In fact, you could see the result of that in the last U.S. Senate race when Senator Collins outperformed the Democrat in a lot of these very same areas because the Democratic candidate, Sarah Gideon, just couldn't win over suburban households, a lot of them.
All right. And Ron, any thoughts on looking at the legislature and the effect of redistricting on local races?
I'm not sure that it's going to be super decisive. In the example of the second district, for example, I don't think that's going to be very decisive. Although, as Steve pointed out, that could very well be another razor thin race, in which case any number of votes could matter.
All right. And when we talk about local races, it's interesting earlier in the program, Steve, I can't remember which of you said that. I think it was Steve who said that races that didn't used to be partisan are becoming partisan on the local level. And I'm wondering if that's even been the case in legislative races, where even though people had a D or an R next to their name, when you came to legislative races, it was more about the person, the character, the how long your family had lived in the town, or how involved they were in the community, how many doors they knocked on. And Steve, I'm wondering if that's still the case.
Yeah, so what you mentioned about the candidate, you know, that is still really important, and it will sometimes transcend partisan affiliation. That's still the case. I mean, we had a special election in a state Senate race here in the Manchester Augusta area, where now Senator Craig Hickman, who is a Democrat, won really convincingly in a special election. Basically doing exactly all the things you just mentioned, which is working his tail off, going door to door, didn't really just hammer Democratic households. He went all over the place, and he won convincingly as a result of that. That said, there is no doubt that these races are becoming more partisan, more nationalized. There's more money, national money, coming in to influence these outcomes. I mean, back in 2010, Republicans were really ahead of the game here in focusing on legislative contests and state house races and governorships in particular, where Democrats had kind of had their eye on presidential races and congressional ones. That has shifted over time. Democrats are increasingly focused on legislative races now, governorships. And so what you have is another sort of arms race that we referenced in fundraising. It's taking place in legislative races as well. There's a lot more focus on state houses than there used to be by national parties and their aligned interest groups. So I expect that the legislative contests next year, writ large, will be very pricey.
Well, it is really always a pleasure to have each of you on the program. That is Steve Missler, Chief Politics and Government Correspondent for Maine Public, and Ron Schmidt, Professor of Political Science at the University of Southern Maine. Today's sound engineer, KG Akimoladun, Jonathan Smith, and Cindy Hahn produce Maine Calling. Today's program will be rebroadcast tonight at 7, and tomorrow on Maine Calling, we will discuss question 1 on the November ballot. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.